one of the analysts on the board here, Erica is not feeling well tonight and asked me to step in to introduce Ellen. So I have a few little housekeeping things. There will be no bathroom break. Donations, please. Flyers for the next lecture are up here. And let me just tell you, the last lecture will be by Jason Smith, and it will be on May 5th, and it's on religious but not religious, the need for a symbolic life. And you can pick up a brochure. I know Jason, he has a background in theater as well as psychology, and he's a lot of fun. So we're fortunate to have him come for our last lecture. There will be a salon at the end of the evening.
At the
Mosaic Cafe.
On Masonic Street.
On Masonic Street in Cal with the rust-colored sweater. You can ask questions about where that's going to be. Erica also asked me to mention that at the C.G. Jung Institute in Boston, the summer intensive will be June 22nd, 23rd, and 24th, and it's going to be on meeting the other within and without, a Jungian encounter with complexity and diversity. And I think there's 21 CEUs that can be attained there. So we're meeting Ellen Peck, Dr. Ellen Peck, who I've only met one other time, so I'll try and do this one. Ellen has been a participant at many of our lectures, and she has a vast set of credentials, which I'll mention. And she travels to the places she speaks of tonight. She is a docent at the Springfield Museum and has a great interest in Jung, in theater, and art history. She does the classical tour at the Springfield Museum. Does that mean you can go downstairs and inside to see some of the things?
How do you arrange that?
Well, you arrange it with the if you want a docent tour.
It's like a private tour.
Yeah, it's like a private tour.
I've heard it's quite wonderful. Ellen was originally from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. She went to Stanford University, got her PhD in English there. You can correct me if I'm off here. She taught, and she's lived in the Valley for over 40 years. She moved here to teach English literature and writing at Mount Holyoke College. Prior to that, she had taught English literature at Wellesley College. I think we're very fortunate to have you in our midst.
Thank you.
You also did a tour for the Association of the Archetypes of Greece. In Greece? Correct? No?
No.
Oh, I know what she wrote here. You did a tour for the Association, for the Western Mass
Yes.
Association.
Yeah, for the Western Mass Association.
But maybe there's a trip ahead. So Ellen is very excited about this topic, and will we have time for questions and answers at the end, or should people ask you?
People can ask as we go along. I mean, this tour is going to divide into two parts, really, and so I'll stop a little bit in the middle.
And we'll stop by 9.
By 9.
Okay. All right. And if you need to use the restroom, just quietly do that, but we're not going to take a break. Okay?
Okay. Can everybody hear me? I have a different kind of mic.
Okay.
Sorry. Weird. Okay. I need to say one more thing about myself. I'm not a therapist. I've been interested in, I've done some Jungian therapy, but my I consider myself still more of a tourist than anything else. But one of the things that got me interested in this topic was that I did visit Pergamon. Have any of you ever been to Pergamon, any of the cities in Turkey? This is one of the Greek cities in the southern and western end of Turkey. It was one of the great cities in the classical world, and it's now kind of gone downhill. But it was fascinating to me to go to this, the Asclepian, which is a very large healing establishment in Pergamon. And I was really surprised that there was a big theater attached to the sacred precinct. But then, since then, I've never heard too much about, you know, what they did in the theater, but it was obviously a part of the ancient healing site. And then I've read since then that other healing sites all had theaters attached to them. Now, of course, you can do a lot of different things in the theater. When we were there, there was a big sign that said Convention of Psychiatrists, and they were all sitting in the theater reading papers and talking just like we are. So I told them there are lots of things you can do in the theater. They probably had concerts as well. But all of these theaters were set up, you know, they were big enough, and they were set up so that they could have full-scale plays. So they must have been part of the healing mechanism of these healing establishments. Okay, I will talk about these ancient healing centers, and then I'm going to, we'll take a little break, and then I'll talk about the theater tradition. How many of you have seen Greek plays put on? Oh, good. About half of the audience. There is a, if you've never seen a Greek theater, there is a Greek theater at Mount Holyoke. It's outside. They have graduations there. So that, if you want to experience a Greek theater, there is one there. It's a small one. But they're really spectacular. And the Greek plays are still performed, depending upon the political situation and the cultural situation, but they have lasted all of these years. After we talk about what they did at some of the healing centers, I would like to talk about one particular play that I think is relevant again for our time. It's The Bacchae by Euripides. It's one of his most best-known plays, and I think it's one of the better plays from this whole tradition. It was written sort of in the middle of the high point of these healing centers, and so it could have been put on. And it brings up some of the themes that we've been talking about in previous talks, and that I think it will point to what we're going to, people will talk about next time as well. Okay. Some books you might find of interest on this topic. The main one is called Healing Dream and Ritual by C.E. Meyer, and I have a copy of it here. He has done a lot of research on these ancient healing centers and the ancient rituals that went along with them. And what he has to say is very very enlightening, I think. The second book is a book of lectures that Jung gave, and he talks a little bit about his admiration for Aristotle there, and Aristotle, the first literary critic who wrote about these plays and about the structure of them, and Jung was quite interested in that, so the introduction to that book talks a lot about how he thought about the theater. And the third book is a book by a literary critic called The Great Code, and it has to do with the way we tell stories if we're in the Christian biblical tradition. So I'll get to that a little later on. Okay. In the ancient world, the Asclepians were the healing institutions. And they were scattered all over the Greek world, and they lasted through to Roman times, and then many of the Christian groups took them over. So in some sense, they still go on. Now, suppose you had a health problem in the ancient world, and you wanted to find something that would be equivalent to therapy today, you might present yourself to the priest at an Asclepian. Now, they wouldn't ask you for your insurance card, but they would vet you before you could come in to the entrance. They wanted to see if you were a good candidate for their healing. They probably did ask you if you could pay your bills. But the main thing they wanted to know was how healthy you were. If you were at death's door, you could not come in. Now, we may think that's odd for a healing institution, but the bargain these healing groups had made with the gods was that death could not come into the sacred precinct. So if you were nearly dead, you couldn't come in either. However, if you could find somebody else to do the rituals for you, you could actually pay a substitute to come in and do the rituals, enjoy the establishment, and dream for you. And I think that's really something. The only thing I've ever heard is like that. One of my friends does Reiki, and she says that you can do that at a distance. Mm-hmm. And I know one time I had given some money to a Native American group out in Arizona, and the high priest of that said, okay, I'm going to go on a sacred journey on your behalf. And he sent me an email describing this sacred journey. And I was so surprised. I mean, I didn't know quite what to make of it, but that idea that you could hire a substitute was an ancient idea, and it still continues. So death was not allowed into the precinct. So if you got in, you might feel very reassured it would be a safe place to be if you were allowed to come in. One of the most important things that Meyer says about these establishments was that the priests and the people worked there did not think of themselves as healers. They thought of themselves as facilitators. What healed you if you came to these places was your own dream. The dreams that you would have and the contact you would have with the god. So they would set you up in a comfortable place away from your daily activities. They would prime the pump, but they were not the healers. You had to heal yourself spiritually. That's a very interesting idea. If you were cured at these, you were supposed to give a testimonial at the end. We still do things like that. But there apparently, in many of these healing institutions, they found little bronze plaques. And people say, you know, healed by such and such. They're pretty standard. But you were apparently required to give a testimonial at the end. Okay. The god who was the god of healing was named Asclepius. And he's a very interesting fellow. We think that he was, first of all, a human doctor, but then over time his story grew and he became a god. He was descended from Apollo and a mortal woman. But as in many of these stories in the classical world, his mother died when he was born. It must have been a common thing that in many of these stories the mother dies. Mm-hmm. And so Zeus took him and said, okay, I will raise you. And he gave him to the centaur Chiron. Centaur, remember, is a horse and a human. And they were considered very good educators because they had animal qualities as well as the brains of a human being. Mm-hmm. So Asclepius, being raised by a centaur, would have qualities of all kinds. He was very successful, apparently, as a healer. And he even brought some people back from the dead. And this aroused the ire of Hades, who said, hey, the underworld is getting depopulated. And so he went to his brother Zeus and said, look, you got to do something about him. So Zeus threw a thunderbolt at Asclepius, and it killed the human part of him, but not the god part. And so he went on as a god and was even promoted to a star. If you were really good in the Greek world, you got to be a star. He was also often portrayed as a wounded healer. Maybe you've run into that convention before, that the person who's been wounded is the one who was able to heal. Sacred to him were snakes. And apparently in these temples, when you first went in, you encountered lots of non-poisonous snakes that were named for Asclepius. And the book said that they were fed on honey cakes. I've never heard of snakes eating honey cakes, but I guess that's what one offered to them. Dogs were also sacred to him. Dogs were considered messengers, and so dogs were around the temples. I think sometimes from the ancient world onward, dogs were also considered good gauges of your character. If a dog liked you, you were okay. So that was part of the vetting process. And then the ritual must have involved doing something with chickens, because there's a saying, when Socrates was about to die, he says to his followers, give a cock to Asclepius. So that must have been part of the ritual. Maybe they killed the chickens, or I don't think they were the meal, but they were presented to him. This is a statue. It's a little distorted here. A statue of the god. And you'll notice that he has a snake that winds itself around a tree. Today, the medical establishment, if you see on a medical building, they'll have two snakes running around. That's actually the staff of Hermes. And apparently somebody got the logo mixed up when they started using that, because it would have been more appropriate to have just one snake, but it probably doesn't matter. The idea was that the snake shed its skin, and they thought that was a kind of symbol of rebirth. Mm-hmm. And so having a snake was sacred. It was also a symbol of wisdom. These are just some of the things about him. The son of Apollo, a god of healing, and struck down by a thunderbolt because he was too successful. That's a compliment that one could do without, actually. Okay, this is, I hope you can see this, this is a little blurry, but this is Asclepius in the middle, and on one side are all of his sons, and on the other side are all of his daughters. And symbolically, this showed that he was very fertile. He had both masculine and feminine progeny, and this was part of his healing, power. That meant that he understood both the feminine and the masculine. He had two daughters that would help him. You see them sometimes portrayed as helping him heal. One of them was named Hygienia, and the other one was named Panacea. Those names. I don't know whether Hygienia gave you a day after. It was probably the mineral baths, but they did help him. Okay, when you came into the healing center, you would walk down this long avenue that was paved. These are still the original paving stones. Sometimes you would walk barefoot, as a pilgrim would do in Christian pilgrimages, and you would come into the main precinct along this sacred road. And you'll notice on the top, this is the Acropolis of the town of Pergamon. And the Acropolis was always the highest point in a city. And there they put the most important temples, because that was where things were closest to the gods. And in this particular one, there was a huge temple of Zeus. So you would come and you would walk through this sacred place, but you would also look up to what was at the top. Okay, in this case, the main temple of the Acropolis was a temple of Zeus. And Zeus is always, this is our Zeus that's down in the Springfield Museum. He always is portrayed as a wise old man. And sometimes we just see his head, because of course that's where his power was. he was, you could call him the head honcho of all the gods. For those of you that know something about the Greek pantheon, there were no omnipotent gods in this polytheistic world. Each god had his own bailiwick and was sovereign there. And that meant that the gods could fight with each other. And Zeus was noted for keeping order. He symbolized the, you know, the benefits of civilization. He was a good politician. He was the father of many of the gods, but he was a good politician too. So when there were disputes, he was the one that settled them. So in the temple, they would portray him as being the symbol of good government. Helping him with establish the rule of law in the city was his daughter Athena, and this is a statue again that's in Springfield. And you'll notice that Athena too has a snake that was sacred to her. The snake and the owl were considered her symbols. She has, I don't know whether you can see it here, she has a gorgon's head in her breastplate because she helped the hero who killed the gorgon, the gorgon's lady with the snakes in her hair. And she will turn you to stone if you look her in the eye. So Athena, who has helped the heroes with stratagems, that's what they thought she was good at, she gave a mirror to the hero Perseus, and he came around back and cut off the gorgon's head while she was looking in the mirror, and then he put it in a sack. And when he was done with the head, Athena got it because she had helped him with this stratagem. Athena was born from Zeus's head. Some of you may have heard this story. Zeus had relationship with her mother, and the mother turned herself into a fly and was buzzing around teasing Zeus, and he swallowed her. And then 9 months later, he had this terrific headache. And so he went to the blacksmith, Hephaestus, and he said, "Oh, my head." And Hephaestus took his axe and broke his head open, and out stepped Athena, fully grown and fully armed. So you always see her portrayed with her armor on as a mature person, because wisdom doesn't seem to have a childhood. It's always mature. And you see Athena as the ally of her father, helping him keep up the rule of law and civilization. And she also has on the top of her head, can you see? It's a little Egyptian symbol of wisdom as well. And so it's like a little sphinx. Can you see that at the top there?
And what time period was that statue made?
That was pretty much the height of the classical period, about 5th century.
Is it a copy?
Oh, yeah. These are all plaster casts.
Okay.
I think the main statue may have been, most of these are in the British Museum. This one is in pretty good shape. Many of them have had damage. Well, Athena was the helper of her father. And this is the altar of Zeus that was at Pergamon. It is now in Berlin. It was reconstructed there. The Germans and the Turks were allies before World War I, and the German archaeologists did all the work at Pergamon and to cement the alliance. They got this huge altar, which is really, really something. I think it survived the war, so it's still in Berlin. But this is a panel that isn't down at the Springfield Museum. It's a panel on the side, and it shows you what the iconography of this particular altar is. This was damaged, I think, in an earthquake. But you can see in the middle Athena, even though she's lost her head, but she has the gorgon, and she is helping her father Zeus put down the race of Titans or giants. These were a race that were preceding people. They helped actually form people. Epimetheus, the potter titan, made men out of clay, and then, of course, the gods brought them to life. And his brother, Prometheus, stole fire from the gods and gave it to people. So they were considered allies of humans. But in many of these Greek stories, you get the impression that the gods were very ambivalent about humans. They would help them, but then they were kind of worried that they might get too big for their britches. They would indulge in hubris or pride. And so in many of these stories, the gods sometimes will help humans and sometimes not. And they felt the same way about the giants, that this race of titans could get boisterous, they could get obstreperous. They seem to represent older cliffonic powers, powers of the earth, basic powers, but you couldn't control them very well. So in this battle scene, you see Athena helping her father push the titans underground, really, I mean, literally suppress them. They were being pushed underground. The mother over here is pleading with Athena, don't, you know, hurt my son who is over here. And Athena is not listening. And the titans in this battle were pushed underground, suppressed, not killed, but suppressed, where they remained underground and rumbled around and caused earthquakes. And on the side here, can you see the winged figure? This winged figure. This is Nike. For whom the shoes are named. Nike was the goddess of victory. And she's always portrayed with wings. And that really intrigues me, because the Greeks thought that victory was not anything you could hold on to. Victory, and when Cupid too, always has wings. So, because they fly about. I mean, sometimes victory will come to you, sometimes it will not. The great temple in Athena's great temple, she's holding out her hand, and victory, the statue that is now gone, but they think that she was holding a 5-foot statue of Nike, but she wasn't grabbing her, she was just holding out her hand so that Nike could land, but she also could fly away. And so this idea of victory as being something you couldn't hold on to, I'm sure it came from the experience being an athlete or being a musician. I mean, some of you maybe have run into this when sometimes you're just in the flow. Everything goes well, and you think, oh, the gods are all with me. And then other times, you know, you can do all the same things and it doesn't work. You know, your reed breaks, you blow a wrong note, or you fall off. My daughter used to be a gymnast, and I would always think, oh no, is this the day of the gods? With her, she would fall off of that one. So that was, I think, one of the reasons they always portrayed victory like that, as flying away. Here Athena is helping her father suppress these disruptive energies that were represented by the Titans. This is the same motif that you see on the Parthenon, which is the temple of Athena. This is an old picture of the Parthenon. The Parthenon is now being rebuilt. But on the front of it, you see these square holes. The Parthenon was blown up in the 17th century, and many of the sculptures fell down. They were taken to Britain, and they're part of the Elgin marble collection in the British Museum. But there were square metopes that were all along the whole temple. And what they were like was this. This was another battle that would read the same way. This is a battle between the centaurs and our race, the early race of humans. And this battle, as I say, goes on all around the temple. But it would say to the Greeks the same thing, that a well-ordered society has human reason, not this sort of half-reasonable, half-animal creature. And the story was that it was a wedding of these humans, these Lapiths, and they invited the centaurs to come, and the centaurs couldn't hold their liquor, and they got very obstreperous. They started to do fraternity boy-type things, and they tried to kidnap the bride, and the Lapiths got very angry, and they started this battle, which, of course, the humans won. So this is a motif of good order, human reason prevails. Okay. And Athena was the also the patron saint of olives. She brought olive trees to Athens. So, the centaurs, as I had said before, were the centaurs were half human and half horse. So they were considered wise, but also undependable. And even though Asclepius was raised by a centaur, he was considered much more dependable. Okay, we're back to Pergamon. This is a picture of some of the sacred precinct. I mean, it's kind of an old picture, but what you can see here is what these establishments would have had. If you were not in good order, as in the city, you would go down to one of these establishments to try to reset order in yourself. And they gave you all kinds of physical means to do this. These places really sounded quite quite elegant. They had pools to wash in, they had mineral baths, they had mud baths, they had a gym, you had the massage, there was a massage area, and there was a theater. You can see the theater in the background. They had a grove where you could eat. And so when you would come to these, you would be given physical comforts and made to feel very safe. Death was not going to get you. But then you could dream, and the most important part was the dormitory. And not too much of that has left, but you can see they had little slots or little cubicles where people slept. And they would sleep and hopefully dream about the different gods that maybe they had offended a god, or maybe they had trouble with one kind of thing. Maybe they didn't have good order. Maybe they were identifying with some of these more base instincts. But you don't know what it was. But the idea was that you had to cure yourself. The doctors, provided comfort and a safe place. But it was your dream and your spirituality that actually cured you. And you were cured, particularly if you dreamt of Asclepius, because he was helping you. But you could dream of other gods as well. And so this was a... They don't know what else people did. There was some contention about whether the priests interpreted the dreams or how they interpreted the dreams. I mean, when people came out of the sleep, they must have told the priests about it, and they must have had some way of verifying that this was a significant dream. But we really don't have very many records of what they said, how were they able to predict it, or how exactly they might have analyzed them. But you did have to stay there until you had a significant dream.
Yeah. The testimonials that you mentioned, mm-hmm. Do they verify any of the dream content?
They don't talk about the content particularly. They just verify that they were cured, or they saw this god. I mean, they're apparently quite formulaic. Mm-hmm. So it would be wonderful to know what people dream, but dreams are so individual that they don't know. But you would know. I mean, just being in a safe place where you're being taken care of in this way would have been really salutary. I just talked to a friend who had been on a contemporary retreat, and she said one of the first things that happened was that everybody around her started dreaming in ways that they wouldn't at home, partly because you're just being removed from your ordinary concerns and feel.
It's like a super spa.
A super spa. It was like a super spa. And the effect that super spas had on you. But it wasn't finally the spa effect that did it. This is another structure that you can't see very well, but it has... This was part of the therapeutic part, and it's a little hard to tell exactly what it is. It's very evocative. Mr. Meyer talks about what went on before these spas, these spa-like places developed, And there were older rituals under the god Trophonius. And some of these were really rather extreme. Some of them are related to rituals that went on in Eleusis under the auspices of Ceres or Demeter. And these, if you had a really difficult problem before these spas were, healing centers were available, and you went to a Trophonius structure, you might be buried for 3 days in a hole. And they have found a few of these structures where people actually crawled into a hole, and I don't know whether they were holed up, but they had to stay in there for about 3 days, and they have had water, but not food. And then they crawled out again as if they were being reborn. In the Mysteries of Eleusis, they did a similar thing with the analogy of a seed that's put in the earth and then is reborn and comes back. And you would, I would have thought that you really were in need of transformation if you would put yourself through a ritual like that. I guess there are other rituals, like Native Americans have rituals like that. And I think the Australians have a kind of walkabout that's like that. So actually burying people in a, that seems a little drastic. I went to Kripalu, or one of our local centers, once, and they were giving one of these, try out all the different things we have to offer. And I tried out something called a sensory deprivation tank. Have you ever heard of these? Have you ever been in one?
Yeah, there's one here in Northampton.
There is one? Oh, I didn't know that. Well, I tried it. It was very strange. I mean, they put you in a tank, and the water is kind of body temperature, and salty water, and they close you up, and you can't hear anything, you can't see anything. It's really, you're very sensory deprived, and you stay in there, and I suppose it could do strange things to you. I felt like, oh my gosh, the time just seemed to disappear, and because there's no marker. I don't know even how long I was in this case. And I think I wasn't in the right psychological mood to come into some place like that. But I can imagine that you could have a real rebirth experience by doing that kind of thing. So this was the previous way to effect some kind of a cure.
What do you think happened in this structure?
They weren't sure that part of this might have been part of the dormitory.
Okay.
Because there were slots and things. And the one part of the dormitory that we saw, there were like holes in the ceiling. There was some speculation, could they have put in incense? Could they have put something in that people would breathe? That would, because in the sanctuary of Apollo, they often wonder if people were breathing fumes that would make them see the future. But it's not very clear that was happening. That there were slots mostly for dormitories. It sometimes it's kind of hard to tell when you go to these places what it is you're seeing. Well, do you think any of you would like to go to a... Well, we have places like that around here.
It sounds like they were trying to create deep relaxation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. And that would... They were kind of priming the internal pump to get you to dream the significant dream. Yeah.
Ellen, there's a course of training in ancient ritual here in Western Mass with Elisa Starkweather.
Mm-hmm.
It's called the Priestess Path.
Oh.
And in that 2-year training, they do these kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
They go underground for 3 days, talk
wow.
to the gods,
mm-hmm.
things like that. And having gone through it, it's one of the most powerful experiences I've had.
Wow.
And it cut through a lot.
Wow.
So the ancient things, just learning from that, these things are work.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't cost as much as a medical professional.
That's right.
No, really.
Yeah.
But they're not involved.
Yeah. And they use your own resources.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, when the Romans took over Greece, you know, they knew a good thing when they saw it. And they kind of swallowed the culture whole. I spent a year in Rome, and it was just amazing how much stuff from Greece had been carted off to Rome. But one of the things that was carted off was the god Asclepius. When the Romans invaded these Greek cities, they said, oh, well, this is a good idea. We want the gods to come to Rome. So apparently with great fanfare, they prepared a boat. They got a statue of the god. They took him from Pergamon. They took him on the sea all over to Italy. They went up the Tiber, and they placed him on the Tiber Island. This is the little island that's in the middle of the Tiber in Rome. And they set up his shrine. This is a medieval hospital that you see there now. But they had an Asclepian in the middle of Rome. And then when the Christians took it over, they put a hospital there. And there's still a hospital there. When we were in Rome, I started doing Jungian therapy there. And one of the things the therapist made me do, he said, you're too heady, you're too much a thinking person, you've got to make sculpture. So I went through this whole course of making little sculptures. When it came time to go home, I couldn't take them all, they were made out of Play-Doh, they would have collapsed. So I said, well, what am I going to do with these sculptures? So my husband and I went down to this Tiber Island, and we decided we would have our own little ceremony of throwing them in the river. So I had no idea that that had been an Asclepian at the time, but we did the right thing, I think. Moving. Okay, this is the father of Asclepius. This is Apollo. He's often seen headless. In Greek mythology, they often talk about opposition between Apollo and Dionysus. Apollo was associated with the rational faculties of music, and he was a god that was acceptable when Christianity came in. You'll see etymologically, some of the statues of Christ were really modeled on statues of Apollo. But I'd like to talk about this fellow. This is Dionysus, who is the god of wine, and this is kind of a late statue. He's often portrayed as a young man with grape leaves in his hair, holding wine. He was the god of inspiration, and he was the god of the theater. The theater apparently was started in honor of Dionysus. And some of the stories show that I think the Greeks were very ambivalent about Dionysus. Because of all the gods, he had a good side and a bad side, just the way wine affects people. Some people are affected very positively, some people are affected very negatively. And Dionysus was that kind of a god. He had a wild pendulum swing of attributes. He was called a late-born god, and it was apparently hard to get his sacredness established. And in some of the play I'm going to talk about, he's very upset about not being given credit as a god. He gave mankind a grape, he also was considered, well, what do we do with him? Is he really a good god, or is he somebody that is not really sacred? These are some of his followers. And you'll notice this little fellow on the side. This is a faun at his feet. And the fauns were considered half human and half goat. You see the bottom of him has goat, like goat feet and hoofs. And those of you that have seen the recent Beauty and the Beast has that same kind of bottom. That iconography has continued from ancient times. When the Christians took over and they had to image the devil, they always made the devil have goat feet and a tail as well, but taken from these statues. The other statue represents important followers of Dionysus. These were the Maenads, the dancers, the Bacchantes. They were women who danced, and danced and went wild in his honor. And a historical note about these figures. Do you all know about the dancer Isadora Duncan? You've heard of her. Well, she was an American. I think she was from San Francisco, but she went to London and went to the British Museum and saw all these statues of Maenads and all the pictures on the vases of dancing women. And she had a brother who was an artist and a mother who was a convenient seamstress. So she took them along and she made her brother draw sketches of all these statues as well as the pictures of the dancers on the vases. And she got her mother to make the costumes. And then she, as an intuitive dancer, tried to put herself into the positions that her brother was drawing. And that was really the way modern dance got started. That's kind of fascinating that these old statues would be used that way. But she saw that would be important. Those of you that know things about India, there's apparently a movement in India to resurrect some of the dance traditions there, too, that were suppressed by the British colonial period. And they do the same thing. They go to the temples and they draw pictures of the old dancers, and then people try to do the movements that are in the statues. Apparently, Isadora Duncan also worked with the Greek theater, the National Greek Theater Company. So I remember seeing a production once that she had helped them do, and she was teaching the chorus how to dance using her movements. And this was a production of Medea, where the chorus was doing modern Isadora Duncan dance movements. Very, very effective. Really, really a good match.
Did you say the dancers were called Maenads?
Maenads.
Oh,
Maenads.
How do you spell that?
And these were the traditional followers. They under the influence of Dionysus, they went up into the hills and they danced.
Pardon me, remember Isadora Duncan dancing a lot with the beautiful scarves and
yes.
The beautiful aesthetics and aesthetic and tragedy that took her at the end when she was in a car with a scarf caught
in her neck, yeah. And she took that idea of the scarves from these statues, and there were a lot of flowing scarves
that
portrayed, yeah. That Dionysus was considered a child of Zeus, an immortal woman who was a princess of Thebes. And she too died when he was born. As I said, this is a motif in many of these stories. And Zeus took him and put him in his thigh. Remember, Athena was from Zeus's head, but Dionysus went into his thigh. And when he was ready to be born, Zeus gave him to what would have been his half-brother, Hermes, and this is a lovely statue of the two brothers of Hermes taking care of the baby Dionysus and raising him. So he took on some of the characteristics of Hermes, who was the god of thieves, and as well as the messenger god, and he became a god when he was an adult. Yeah.
And Zeus had all the different daughters, and Polyhymnia was the daughter of religious music, so that's where the word hymns came from, Polyhymnia.
Uh-huh.
And the calliope was a beautiful voice.
Mm-hmm.
And the calliope is an instrument that was then used for the circus, where it sounded like an organ with steam-tuned whistles that sounded like flutes.
Mm-hmm. When Zeus, when he was rescued and grew up with under the tutelage of Hermes. He apparently was raised to be an adult, but in many of the stories about Dionysus, he's a bit he's portrayed as somebody who's very uneasy and defensive about his origins because he wants to be taken seriously as a god. This is the largest extant Greek theater somebody has me about this. This is at Epidaurus, which was also an Aesculapian. And it's a huge, it's still working, and you can stand down there and of course be heard. The acoustics are just amazing.
This is Greece itself or Turkey? This is Greece itself.
This is in Turkey.
It's still in Turkey.
It's Turkey. Most of the best ruins of Greek cities are in Turkey because they were dug up later. The Romans went into Greece and just took as much as they could, but in Turkey, I think they were more. Well, and they were under the bit more the Byzantine part of the
so
empire.
So these are all on the coast.
Yeah, they're all on the coast. Yeah, all in the western part of Turkey.
Yeah, it's sad that the Greeks were thrown out.
Yes.
In 1922, it's like 200,000 or 300,000 people not enough.
Yeah. When we were on this tour of this part of Turkey, we went to a lot of sites that were Greek sites, and our guide was a Muslim. He didn't know anything about them, and didn't know anything about the iconography of Christianity or anything. I found myself giving lectures about the iconology of Christianity. But you know, they do try to preserve these Greek monuments, even though they don't validate them anymore. Yeah.
Did you go to the top and actually be able to hear people?
Yeah, and you really can. They figure it out. How it's the slope of the. It's even true in Mount Holyoke's little theater. You can hear people very well. Okay, the theater, as I said, was started as a ritual in honor of Dionysus. And at first they think that it was just a bunch of people chanting poetry. They maybe were dancing, but they were chanting in his honor. And then gradually plots became added to it. First one character, then two characters. The first actor was called Thespis that we know of, and we call actors now Thespians. Now, but he was a real person who acted in some of the plays. Over time, the celebration for Dionysus got to be more and more ordered, and it got to be a real contest. So the playwrights were given a chance to write plays, and it would be like the Olympics. They would compete for prizes, and they'd be voted on. And so we have some of the plays that are extant. You know, they're noted as, oh, this won the prize in this year, and that won the prize. So they were very competitive in everything they did.
Another Greek question is, from what I understand, were a lot of the Greek playwrights combat veterans, because they were always, the city states were constantly in war.
Oh, constantly.
The actors were all combat veterans, and the entire audience were combat veterans. So when they have PTSD and haunted by the horrors they had to do in combat, by seeing these plays, they were, or you might get into it later, they were healed. It was a healing. They could purge their demons through the plays.
First was just the chorus saying things, then maybe it brought in main actors, and the conventions developed that there were several actors, main actors, that were individuals, and they were up on a raised platform. You don't see much of a raised platform there. The chorus was down in a circle, which was called an orchestra. And so the structure became the individuals dialoguing with each other and dialoguing with the chorus. And as I said, the chorus would chant, and they think the chorus danced as well and sang. But what really struck me about how you would put the theater and therapy together is how these plays are structured, because apparently the Greek audiences didn't like to see action a violent action in front of them. They didn't want to see somebody being murdered. I mean, these are very violent plays, and you're right that there were certainly lots of veteran people there. But the audience didn't want to see that. So the structure of these plays, the main characters come out, and they tell their stories. It's very, very much exposition. They're telling you. But it's just like in a therapy situation where you have a person telling you what's happened. You don't see the things that have made them do stuff. You just have to go on the, you know, what the person tells you. Well, that's the way these plays are structured. The main characters tell you their story, and then if there's action, a messenger will come in and describe the action, or someone else will come in and describe it. But it's dialogue, and the drama is very internal in many of these plays, because something has happened and the main character has to respond to it, or the main character is trying to decide, what am I going to do? Like Medea is just trying to decide, am I going to kill my children? And then the chorus is giving it's sort of the communal or like the ordinary audience person, you know, responding to that and arguing sometimes with the main character or giving some kind of feedback. So there's a sense that it was very therapeutic. Mm-hmm. And especially because it must have been put into this.
The playwrights were combat veterans, a lot of them.
They're
artists that went to war.
Yeah.
And then they created this work.
And all the actors were men.
Yeah, yeah.
Even though they were taking, and they did wear masks so that you could tell who they were. The masks were called persona. And that, we know that it's a psychological term. That's the part that you show to the world, and that's the part that they showed to the world. They were simple costumes, but then one actor could have several persona. And it, you know, a Christian theology, you have God in three persons. That's what it refers to, three masks that he wears. And so that's...
I understand that persona means to speak through.
Through, yes.
And so that's why it became a psychological term. It was that which we speak through,
mm-hmm.
and that we want others to see about ourselves.
People used to think that those masks helped amplify the sound.
I don't think they did.
I don't think they did. They were speaking through them, but they were not. Yeah.
I have a question about the theater smiling and the frowning mask, and they said if you take one too seriously, one will smile, the other will frown. Where did that originate? Was that also from Greek theater?
Yes. I'll get to that in a second.
Thank you.
Okay, yeah. So you have to imagine the main characters and then the chorus and the dialogue going on between them, and they don't always have the same point of view. So in a way, you're working out different conflicts within the play. Okay. Now another goddess that you have to think about when you think about Greek. This is a sketch by Durer, but it's of the goddess Tike, or Fortuna. And this goddess played, you don't maybe associate her with the theater, but the idea of Fortuna played a part in how these plays were structured. You'll see that she's standing on a wheel which turns, and she was often the goddess, she's the goddess of fortune. She was often portrayed at the entrance to a commercial establishment or commercial town. St. Paul sometimes preaches in front of a statue of Fortuna or Tike. And she here has wings because she kind of flies around, and Durer imagines her sort of ruling over the little town below. But you can see her a little in this picture. This is a medieval picture of the wheel of fortune. And we still have a game wheel of fortune. But the way Greek plays were structured had to do with this idea of the wheel of fortune.
You can see the goddess in the middle. You can see the king at the top, and then the person that's falling down. You can see a corpse or a beggar at the bottom, and then you see a rise on the other side. Now, if you draw a line, a diagonal line, through this diagram, you get the structure of comedy and tragedy. And how these first came about. They thought of tragedy as the right half of this wheel. And usually in a tragedy, the main characters go to their top position. They rise in the beginning, and then something happens and they fall. And the play ends with fall down at the bottom. In the comic pattern, it's just the opposite. Usually there's a catastrophe in the beginning. Someone falls, and then there's a rise. And the story doesn't end until you get that rise. I mentioned earlier on the book, The Great Code, this literary critic named Northrop Frye talks about the Bible as being a comic pattern. Now, we don't think of the Bible as comic, but in this sense it is. From the beginning to the end of the Bible, if you think about it, in the beginning is the fall of man. Right? Adam and Eve, they fell. And all the stories have this comic pattern. There's a fall, and then there's a rise. And you don't stop telling the story until you get the rise. And the whole Bible is structured that way. You have the fall of man, and you have all of these stories in the middle, and you end with triumph, which is the comic pattern. Dante called his work the Divine Comedy. He didn't mean it was funny. He meant that it was this pattern here. The Greeks seem to like the tragic pattern, and that is a little, when you read a lot of Greek literature, that really is striking. Maybe it's because of what has survived. Now, there were, in the Greek theater, there were comedies, tragedies, and something called a satyr play, which was really a slapstick play, and most of those are not extant. There are a few comedies that have been extant, but it was interesting. Women would not be allowed to go to comedies in the Greek theater because they were so satiric, and they were considered corrupting. They were allowed to go to tragedies.
Wow.
And some of the comedies are very, I mean, a lot of them haven't survived because they were so topical. Some of you may have read plays by Aristophanes. He was one of the great comic writers. There's one I wish they would revive. It's called The Birds, and it's about people from Athens are so fed up with the politics of Athens that they decide they're going to defect and they're going to go to the kingdom of the birds, which is a naive kingdom. It doesn't have any politics. And of course, the more Athenians come, the more corrupted the birds become. And finally, it becomes like Athens. It would be a difficult play to translate because it's so topical. I mean, there are topical references. There's another comedy that is pretty much, it's played occasionally. It's called Lysistrata. Have any of you ever seen that? This is a play about the women of Athens that decide they've had enough of war, and so they go on strike and they hold themselves up in the Acropolis, and that's one of the raunchiest plays I have ever seen. The men are parading around holding up phalluses on a pole, and the women are taunting them, and the gay guys are saying, "Don't worry about the women, we're still down here." And of course the women win because they win. That play started to be performed in the 60s when nobody could, of course. And actually, I think the South Hadley Performing Arts School for Teenagers put that on. I was surprised.
I think they played it during the Iraq War.
That's a play that does survive. You know, but most of the plays that do survive are in this tragic pattern rather than the comic pattern.
You haven't heard of Spike Lee, the director? He made a modern interpretation of, I thought it was pronounced Lysistrata, but he made one. It's called Chirac, and it's set in Chicago, but it's the play, but it's mm-hmm. modern time. That was mm-hmm. very,
very good.
Yeah.
You know, these old plot lines are really good. I mean, they are. In the tragedy, you had this negative wheel of fortune, and that the stories in the tragedy seemed to be more mythical stories and more traditional stories. They didn't have a lot of contemporary references, and so they translate pretty well, and more of them exist. Aristotle was the one who gave us the terms pity and terror. This is what he thought happened to the audience watching a tragedy. They felt pity for the people suffering these agonies, and they felt terror that even such great people could be done in by fate or by their own mistakes. And they would. He thought that watching a tragedy was curative, because you would identify with these people and you would be glad it wasn't you, and you would have an experience called catharsis. This is something that you've probably heard of, if you still use that term, meaning you have a cleaning out by identifying with some of these characters. I said that here are some of the masks that you're talking about. These are the masks that are called persona. These are from Hadrian's villa. They're a mosaic, and they're really startling. They didn't have any makeup, so these masks were very, very dramatic. When you would go to the theater, apparently you would get theater tickets in the shape of these masks, and they still sort of tell them they're made out of clay, and they give you these little theater tickets. Just another word about the Bible and the great code of Christian storytelling. I remember taking a course in ministry once in which we were taught to tell our stories but not finish the story, not put the frame of the story until we had had some kind of resurrection moment. And I was kind of surprised by this, but it sort of showed that I think our culture is very much primed to the comic pattern rather than the tragic pattern. A number of years ago, I went to a play in New York. I don't know whether any of you saw this. It was based on Ovid's The Metamorphoses. The play was called The Metamorphoses. Did any of you?
Mary Zimmerman.
Yeah, you saw that. Well, it was a really wonderful play, because it used. If you don't know some of these stories, I would suggest you read Ovid's Metamorphoses. These are the small stories that talk about all of these Greek characters. It was done by a Roman writer, but he collected them as Greek stories, and they're some of the famous stories that we know. Well, this play, it was really very well staged. You saw that, didn't you? It had water. It was like a big swimming pool of water. Did you see that? And the gods were up on a balcony, and they could interact, and people were kind of around in the water, and they really did a good job with all of these stories. But near the end of the play, you could feel the audience getting very upset and uncomfortable. And so finally, one of the actors breaks out of the role and starts to berate the gods and says, "Why aren't you doing anything nice to people? Why are you doing so many bad things? Why aren't you helping them? And, you know, what's the matter with you gods?" And so then the play ends with a story where the gods really do something nice about people. It's in. Zeus and Hermes, in disguise, go to visit this old couple, and they're treated royally. It's one of those, be nice angels in disguise kind of things. And the old couple are rewarded for being nice to these gods. But then I was thinking afterwards, that's really true. You know, for a modern audience, this was quite upsetting to see so many negative things that were done by the gods, and the predominance
difficulties, because we expect the gods to help us.
I never thought of this before, but I believe they had something called a fatal flaw.
Mm-hmm.
So the main characters would do themselves in
yes.
by
this
fatal flaw.
Mm-hmm.
And I can see people, the pity and terror around that.
Yeah.
And to become aware of their own fatal flaws, or their own shadow side,
yeah.
as a Jungian would call it.
Yeah.
And maybe find a way to work with that
mm-hmm.
and be healed from it. Yeah, I never thought of that before. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, it's either a fatal flaw or hubris.
Yes, it was often
a
hubris. Yes, yes.
Wasn't the point of that play, Metamorphosis, and the fact that Mary Zimmerman designed it so that they were in water?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that a Jungian symbol for transformation?
So that the
theatrical point, the dramatic point of that, is that there can be no transformation without pain, without that arduous experience,
mm-hmm.
and that is the essence of the drama
mm-hmm.
of Metamorphosis.
Some of the Latin stories also involve water.
Right, they have to be
in the water.
So she designed it so that those characters were all in the water
mm-hmm.
as a way of, it's kind of like resurrection
mm-hmm.
through the transformational pain and tragedy.
Mm-hmm. Apparently the actors were very uncomfortable in that play too, because
yeah.
they get cold and they need to go in and out of the water.
Also the people in the front row.
And the people in the front row too. Did you saw that too?
It's kind of natural. I'm trying to remember. I remember the actors were in the water. It was
mm-hmm.
very strange.
Yeah.
It was like a waist high pool
mm-hmm.
or something.
Wow.
It was
yeah.
a circle in the square, so it was actually surrounding the stage.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't that high up. It was probably, most of them, it was like up to their knees.
Mm-hmm.
But they were going into the water.
Yeah, it was
yeah.
very unusual.
It's a lot of splashing.
Yeah.
yeah. That was definitely a play where the gods were finally rebuked for being too harsh. And that's, I mean, people that, I don't know whether any of you have had this experience of reading classical literature, that you do get that impression that the gods could be harsh. I think that wasn't that Nietzsche's point about them, that they wanted you to be tough because you couldn't count on the gods to come and help you. And
do you know who those two are in those masks?
One is a comic mask and one is they're kind of generic masks. I don't know. Okay. Do any of the other of you have any want to say anything else about, you know, anything struck you here? Because I'm going to stop for a minute. And I want to go on and talk about a play by this fellow who has a very nice face. This is called Euripides, and the statue makes him seem like a very kindly soul. But before I get into that. Anybody else have things? Yeah.
One other question. Wasn't
yeah.
there one time during the year where the Greek playwrights had competition and there was a prize that
yes.
had the best play?
Mm-hmm.
And it was like a big religious.
Yeah.
It was like
oh.
religious. And also the
yeah.
another question. How many plays were saved? But the ones we have is like only like what 20% of what they thought they
yeah.
were wrote.
Oh yeah. I don't know what the statistics are, but they're not very many.
Can you tell us about the religious aspect of the competition? And, I mean, it just seems like this culture has our Super Bowl sports.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
they have their sports in Greece, but
mm-hmm.
an artistic, that's the high point of the year was the competition.
Well, we have Emmy Awards and we have Oscars and stuff like that.
But wasn't it true that the audience knew all the stories?
Oh, yes, yes.
So the playwright's job is to create yet more pity and terror.
Yes. Mm, yes.
Out of the story everybody already knew.
Right, yeah. And Aristotle thought that was better than than history, because you could see the patterns so
yeah.
much more clearly. I mean, he's the first one that I know of that really makes a good case for fiction.
Yeah.
And is that where the word trope derives?
Trope, that's a part of it, yeah. But it's making... I mean, that's how the archetypes that we talk about got embodied. I mean, they wanted to... the playwrights and the poets gave them a body and a story, and how they interact, how different forces interacted with each other.
Was it just said Athena at the top of her head had an Egyptian symbol there.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering to what extent the Greeks were influenced by Egyptian civilization, which preceded their civilization by 1,000 years or whatever.
There were tribes.
They had similar healing temples there in Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
They had drinking temples and water temples
mm-hmm.
and other temples. So it
yeah.
seems Egypt was really prototype for Greece, and they just
mm-hmm.
elaborated on it.
Yeah. There's a lot more trade back and forth too than people realize. If you go to around the Mediterranean or the Aegean Sea right now with the divers, they're bringing up all these wrecks full of you see amphorae everywhere. You know, the big vases where they used to ship olive oil and
yeah.
wine, and they that sea must have been pretty treacherous. Because there were lots of wrecks, but there was also an awful lot of trade, so that there were travelers from Greece that went to Egypt, and so they didn't know there was enough going back and forth. I don't know how the healing ritual, exactly what the healing rituals were in Egypt that would have influenced them, but they would have known about them. I think the Egyptians were actually better at real medicine, because they had... They knew how to, was it trepan the skulls and set bones? And I remember going through Egypt and seeing some of the old tools, and I was really surprised at what they could do. But in these healing things, they didn't set any bones, and they didn't do any wounds. It was all psychological healing. Mm-hmm.
What was the role of the chorus? Why was the chorus in the play? Do they provide context, or...?
They represented the audience, and they represented ordinary people that were interested in what was going on. And
the
it
union
was,
would be collective.
It would be like the, you know, it would be the collective.
They were kibbutzing.
Oh, yeah, sure. They were gossips. they were pretty... everybody needs an audience, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if you're going through a trauma, you do like an audience. And so they provided a kind of audience.
Yeah, does the catharsis of the play contribute to the dream work at all?
I would think it would, because if you had a play that was about an issue that you were dealing with in yourself, it would kind of prime the pump, I would think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If appropriate, I'd like to share a couple of thoughts about Asclepius.
Sure.
The Romans named a constellation Ophiuchus,
mm-hmm.
which is the serpent bearer.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know Ophiuchus.
Mm-hmm.
And it falls between Scorpius and Scorpio and Sagittarius.
Mm-hmm.
And starting in the 1970s, some astrologers thought that there should be a 13th zodiac sign that would be Ophiuchus. It occupies most of Sagittarius, which is
mm-hmm.
Centaur, plus a little bit of the stinging Scorpio.
Mm-hmm.
So you have the cure of poison there.
Mm-hmm.
And also, relative to cure of poison and Asclepius, there's a plant genus worldwide, Asclepius, which is milkweed.
Mm-hmm.
Milkweed itself is a poison cure as well. It's a host plant for milkweed butterflies.
Mm-hmm.
Cardiac glycosides, heart toxins
mm-hmm.
present in the sap of the plant, but that plant is also used to treat influenza as an expectorant for bronchial disorders, etc. So just some additional symbolism and archetypes for the group to
yeah.
consider.
Yeah.
Remembering that beautiful picture of the amphitheater
mm-hmm.
and all the work that went into it, like the question came to me, what else was that used for besides plays or art or culture?
Concerts, probably.
political speeches, probably.
Probably in political speeches.
Yeah, anything.
It's like Madison Square
Garden. Madison Square Garden, too. I mean, they were the biggest buildings in town. So they, whatever. Yeah.
Well, people had to vote. There's a democracy on major political decisions. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't think they voted in the theater. They went to the temples to vote. It was a Senate building and stuff. But, Well, as I was saying, I'd like to talk just a little bit about one particular play to give you a specific example. This is a play by Euripides, and this was a late play. I think he won a prize for this play, but it was put on posthumously because he wrote it toward the end of his life, and it is a kind of play that maybe one would write at the end of one's life. This is a cover of a CD. You can get a full reading of this. And I put it on here because you can see some of the costumes. The women, these are maenads, and they're wearing what are called fawn skins. They were actual skins of fawns. That was part of their costume. And the two main characters are here, Dionysus and Pentheus. I don't know whether that's blood or just part of the... part of the design there, but this is a play. Have any of you ever seen this play? The Bacchae.
I've read it, but I haven't seen it.
You haven't seen it. I encountered this play in the 60s when I was at Stanford, and I had a poetry teacher who wanted us to read this play because he was frightened. I mean, this was when Dionysic energy was coming up out of the woodwork and out of the area, and he was afraid that some of the young poets that he was mentoring would be swept away by this resurgence of different of Dionysic energy, and indeed that did happen. So I have some attachment to this play in a personal way. I'll give you a summary of this play. This play takes place in Thebes, and Dionysus, in the god we've talked about, in disguise, returns to his native city with a band of female followers, these maenads or bacchante. And he wants to redeem his mother's reputation and take revenge on the city that has rejected her. His mother died when he was born. This is another one, and he was rescued from that, and of course given to his brother Hermes to raise. But the people in Thebes, he tells us in the beginning of this play, the people of Thebes thought that his mother was lying when she said Zeus was the father of this baby. And we've heard this story before, too.
An old story.
Her name was in disrepute, but he grew up. And he comes back to his city and wants to be taken in as a god. But the current ruler of the city is named Pentheus. He's a very young man. He's the grandson of the founder of the city, Cadmus. He's young, he's ambitious for himself as a ruler, and he's very anxious about law and order being sustained in the city. Remember the temple of Athena, they were pressing down the disordered things. Well, he's of that kind. He returns, and he's been away from, when the play opens, he's been away from the city, and he returns, and he finds that chaos is breaking out because this stranger has been luring all the women of the city to go out with him to the hills and to dance and to do his rituals. And he says, what could they be doing? They must be having orgies up here. This must be awful. And he gets very indignant. Begins to berate Dionysus. And Dionysus is a character in this play, but he's in disguise as a mortal person. So he
he tries to defend himself, and there are a number of dialogues. I won't have time to read too many of them, but I'll just read a little bit. He is trying to tell Pentheus that he is a god and that he needs to be worshipped as a god, and his energy needs to be taken seriously. But Pentheus is very upset. He says, "I happen to be away out of the city. Reports reach me of some strange mischief here, stories of women, imagine, leaving home to frisk in mock ecstasies among the thickets on the mountain, dancing in honor of the latest divinity, a certain Dionysus, whoever he may be. In their midst stand bowls brimming with wine, and then one by one the women wander off to hidden nooks where they may serve the lusts of men." He makes everything pornographic. "Priestesses of Bacchus, they claim to be, but it's really Aphrodite they adore. I've captured some of them. My jailers have locked them up in the safety of a prison. Those who run at large will be hunted down out of the mountains like the animals they are. Yes, even my own mother, Argive, Eno, and Atomwe, the mother of Actaeon. In no time I shall have them trapped in iron nets and stop this obscene disorder." You've heard this. He's young, he's trying to be a good ruler, and his grandfather and the priestess Tiresias, two old men, come on, and they try to reason with him, and they try to tell him, now, calm down, don't get so upset about all this. These people are not they're not as bad as you think they are. He says, "I tell you, this god whom you ridicule shall someday have enormous power and prestige throughout Hellas. Mankind, young man, possesses two supreme blessings. First of these is the goddess Demeter, or Earth, whichever name you choose to call her. It was she who gave man his nourishment of grain, but after her there came the son of Semele," that's Dionysus' mother, "who matched her present by inventing liquid wine as his gift to man. Fulfilled with that good gift, suffering mankind forgets its grief. From it comes sleep, with it oblivion of the troubles of the day. There are no other medicine for misery. And when we pour libations to the gods, we pour the god of wine himself, that through his intercession man may win the favor of heaven." Well, Pentheus doesn't listen. He keeps thinking that this can't be good, that if actual women are worshiping Dionysus. So a messenger comes in. They say you don't see anything happening on stage. You just, people come and tell you things. So a messenger comes and tries to tell him what's actually going on up on the mountains. And to him it doesn't seem so bad. He says, "About that hour when the sun lets loose its light to warm the earth, our grazing herds of cows had just begun to climb the path along the mountain ridge. Suddenly I saw three companies of dancing women, one led by Autonomy, the second captured by your mother, Agave, and while Eno led the third, there they lay in deep sleep of exhaustion, some resting on boughs of fir, others sleeping where they fell, here and there among the oak leaves, but all modestly and soberly, not as you think, drunk with wine, nor wandering led astray by the music of the flute to hunt their Aphrodite through the woods. But your mother heard the lowing of great horned herds, and springing to her feet, gave a great cry to welcome them from sleep. And they too, rubbing the bloom of soft sleep from their eyes, rose up lightly and straight, a lovely sight to see. All as one, the old women and the young and the unmarried girls. First they let their hair fall loose down over their shoulders, and those whose straps had slipped fastened their skins of fawn with writhing snakes that licked their cheeks. Breasts swollen with milk, new mothers who had left their babies behind at home, nestled gazelles and young wolves in their arms, suckling them. Then they crowned their heads with leaves, ivy and oak, and flowered irony. One woman struck her thesis against a rock, and a fountain of cool water came bubbling up. Another dove her fennel into the ground, and where it struck the earth at the touch of a god, a spring of wine poured out. Those who wanted milk scratched at the soil with bare fingers, and white milk came welting up. pure honey spurted, streaming from their wands. If you had been there and seen these wonders for yourself, you would have gone down on your knees and prayed to the God you now deny. Well, he's not listening.
Yeah.
So, then things kind of turn, and you hear that these women, you know, they're having this idyllic communion with the earth. But then they get disturbed, and then they get vicious, and this is the turn, you know, the good side and the bad side of this god. Because when they are disturbed, flames flickered in their curls and did not burn them. Then the villagers, furious at what the women did, took to arms, and their sire was something terrible to see, for the men's spears were pointed and sharp, and yet drew no blood, whereas the wands of the women threw inflicted wounds. Then the men ran, routed by women. Some god, I say, was with them. The Bacchae then returned where they had started, by the springs the god had made, and washed their hands, while the snakes licked away the drops of blood that dappled their cheeks. They could rout all these men, and the Pentheus isn't really taking this in, and thinks, oh, there's, you know, must be no good. Well, you can imagine what happens. Pentheus is very curious about what's going on, even though he puts Dionysus and his followers in jail. And of course, he's a god, so he escapes from jail and comes back at him. And he recognizes, you know, that Pentheus, even though he's hostile, he's really curious. He wants to know what's going on. So he says, okay, you put on the disguise, you put on the women's clothing, and I'll take you up to the and show you what's going on. And Pentheus falls for this. So they go up to the hills, and then the messenger tells us that Pentheus climbs a tree to see better, and the god tells the women, you know, some, you know, a hostile force is up the tree. They shake the tree, they tear the tree down, and then they tear him apart. And this is really tear him apart. Yeah, that's what this picture is. They're about to tear him apart. And the worst of it is that his own mother tears his head off and puts it on a pole, and she thinks that she's killed a deer. And so, at the last scene of this play, you have the mother and the Bacchante coming back into the town. She's holding the head on a pole. They would show you this. And then she gets to the middle of the town, and the madness leaves her, and she looks and she realizes, you know, this is her son. And the god is unrepentant. But the two old men, who are kind of the wise old men, start to rebuke the god. And they said, we have learned, you know, Dionysus, you have done wrong. And Dionysus said, it's too late. When there was time, you did not know me. I gave you a warning. And he says, no, we have learned, but your sentence is too harsh. He says, I was a god. I was blasphemed by you. And Cadmus says, well, gods should be exempt from human passions. You shouldn't have been so, you know, you shouldn't have been so bad, so upset. But then that's it. That, you know, it's stuck. That you've had the good and the bad. And the chorus here, the chorus at the end of this is terrible. They say, finally, they kind of throw up their hands and they say, the gods have many shapes, the gods bring many things to their accomplishment, and what was most expected has not been accomplished, but God has found his way for what no man expected. So ends this play. In other words, they're saying, you never know what the gods are going to do, and this is what they've done today. It's really awful.
One shouldn't be where one doesn't belong.
Oh, yes. But then one's own mother shouldn't really tear you up. Jesus. As I say, we read this play early in the 60s when this kind of energy was erupting all around. And one of the people I was in school with was the poet Robert Pinsky, who was one of the poet laureates later on. And he was so struck by this that he wrote a poem that's called Essay on Psychiatrists. I would recommend it to you. It's a really long thing, but he's debating. He says, now, who would the psychiatrists side with? Would they side with Pentheus? Or would they side with Dionysus? Who are the psychiatrists here? Who are, where would they vote? But this was a play. This play has also gone through a number of versions. I don't know whether any of you know the writer Wol Soyinka. He was at Smith a while ago. He's a Nigerian playwright. He put on a number of his plays around here. I think that you may ask. And he translated this play, and I heard him talk about it. And he said, "Well, we could put this play as an essay on colonialism and what it did to African religions," because he identified Dionysus very much with his own god Ngun. And so he has a translation of this where he adds the issue of slavery in here. So this kind of play is one that I would recommend to you if you want to if you haven't read a Greek play. This is a very interesting one, and I think the tension between the chthonic, the kind of energy that Dionysus represents, and the kind of energy that the good government types represent is still very much with us. And trying to adjudicate this and get a balance is, I'm sure that was part of what happened in these healing centers, and I mean, I think that tension is still very much with us.
I think some psychiatrists might say that if you don't pay attention to this energy that is around, you may pay a very bad price.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And especially if you don't acknowledge that it's a godlike energy.
Yes.
And,
I just wanted to mention another play by Euripides that I had seen in Cambridge. I don't remember the name of it, but it just is pertinent to the times. And it was these refugees were all in this boat, and the president of Athens was a woman, and she had two male advisors, and they were trying to figure out whether to let the boat into Athens. And so they were looking at things from all kinds of levels, from the emotional level, from the heart level, from the practical level. You know, we can't do this, but we have to do it. In the meantime, I was feeling very strongly, and what happened was everybody who was sitting on the sidelines were actual refugees.
Oh, my.
And so it was such a deep experience, and they did let the refugees in, by the way. And I just feel like I need to share that in the times.
That must have been a play with refugees from the Trojan War, because there are a number of plays where they're trying to find refuge after Troy is destroyed.
I don't know if you're familiar with the poet Anne Carson. I was just noticing on campus today that there's a version of the Zakai that's going to be put on here at Smith later this month.
Oh,
written by her.
Wow, very good. Has she made a new translation of it?
Apparently.
Oh, wow.
I just saw
that's interesting. Yeah.
I think I just saw one called Hurricane Diane. That takes place in New Jersey, and Dionysus is a lesbian gardener. into a suburban neighborhood. Pretty sure it's a musical.
you never know.
Anne Carson is actually a classicist. And writes a lot of prose and also theatrical performance art and Ron MacArthur for the way in which she integrates, with the Greeks into her. I think her PhD is in the classics. So that production is probably
that'll be interesting. You don't know when it is. It's going to be soon.
I took a picture of the poster, so I can tell you. It's April 21st, 22nd, 27th,
28th,
29th.
That's your Smith?
Yeah.
It's a poster, actually.
Very interesting.
Yeah. You know, I'm struck with a Euripides play. I think it's Heraclitus. I can't remember the play where the wars are escalating in Syria last night, and the last 15 years we've been involved in these wars. And the play is about a combat veteran that is traumatized by war so much. He comes back and he's tainted by this horror, and then he hallucinates that his wife and his children are the enemy, that he's in combat.
Oh.
So he's not in combat reality, but the war is still inside. Mm-hmm. And he murders his wife and his children. And then he's going to commit suicide in the play. And then a combat veteran comes to him and loves him, cares for him. And then he snaps out of this psychosis, or whatever the right word is. And at the end of the play, I remember there's a quote, I think at the end of the play, I'm not sure the exact words, but he said, the playwright, Euripides says, he who loves wealth and power instead of love of his friends, is sick to the core of his soul. Mm-hmm. But the power of love to heal or compassion for fellow human beings. So his friend came to him and pulled him out of that. It's an incredible play.
Remember the name of that book's name?
I think it's the same playwright. I can't pronounce it, though. It's a Heraclitus? Heracles? Heraclitus? But I urge people to read it. It's just a wonderful play.
Yeah.
It's the same playwright. let me add something. When we first invaded Afghanistan, mm-hmm. the people at the tip of the spears, the special forces, mm-hmm. saw a lot of combat horrors in villages and they came back and they brought, I remember after that invasion, some special forces in North Carolina, there were a few incidents where they killed their wives. There were three or four of them.
Oh, yes, sir.
This is a true story. So,
well, there's a whole series of Greek plays where they come back from the Trojan War, the family of Atreus. And he has had to the first play is Iphigenia in Aulis, where he has had to sacrifice his daughter in order to make the wind blow so that the things can go off. And of course, the Greeks knew that. There's a controversial thesis about the frieze of Parthenon, that that's really a sacrifice of a young girl, too, so that they can win a war.
Yeah.
Everybody thought it was just a nice little freeze about the celebration of Athena, but then someone found a bit of an old play that said no, the daughters of Erechtheum, one of the old kings, had to be sacrificed so they could win a battle. So that's an old motif. But then the house of there's a whole lot of those plays are extant. The house of Atreus, where the mother. Clytemnestra is angry that her daughter has been killed, so when Agamemnon comes back as the hero of the war, she murders him. And then his two children, Electra and Orestes, say, well, we have to take revenge for our father, so they murder their mother. And then in the fourth play, poor Orestes has gone mad, and the Furies are after him because you don't murder your mother. And they have to go. That play actually becomes a comedy. The last play, the Orestes play.
Favor.
What?
Is it called Favor?
No, that's a different. That's a different one. No, this is called there's Electra, and then there's Orestes. And the Orestes play, they have to call in the god. That takes on a comic aspect of all these plays, because they have to call in the gods because there's so much chaos and nobody has won the war, and they have to get rid of the Furies, and that's and so the poor fellow is put on trial, and the gods come in and settle it. And that is a more resurrection kind of pattern at the end of its long series.
Actually, what happens there is that the humans resolve it. Athena sets up a trial.
That's right. There's a trial in Athens.
Once the Furies have presented their case, they're there to bring justice to Clytemnestra, who's been killed.
Mm-hmm.
Her son killed her.
Yeah.
And they represent an appeal for justice, mm-hmm. that was done there.
Mm-hmm.
And Athena just says, this is too hard for me to work out. And she turns it over to
the people.
The trial by a jury.
Mm-hmm.
And the jury renders a split decision.
it's balanced like mm-hmm. justice mm-hmm. of both sides. Yeah. There is no easy answer to it.
Yeah.
And only then does Athena say, that being the case, I will... And she forgives.
She forgives him.
Orestes. Yeah. So there's a resolution, but it comes from humans. Yeah. So it's interesting that at least as Aeschylus saw it,
yeah.
humans finally have to resolve these things. The gods can help, but the humans have to do the
resolution. For the hard work, yeah.
And they thought, it's interesting on this day where we've just gotten a new Supreme Court justice, but they thought that was the most precious thing is preserve the sense of human justice, which mixes compassion as well as reason. Mm-hmm. And it's such a beautiful play, really.
I think there are several versions of that final play that are read that Orestes.
Well, each of the playwrights wrote a version. It's true, but Aeschylus' yeah. version ends. He was the original. This is yeah. how it ends, and then Sophocles wrote one, and then Euripides wrote one, because it was the great play of Athens.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's the one where finally everybody turns on Helen of Troy because she has...
That's Euripides, yeah.
Yeah, because she has caused this great war, and she's like a movie star. She kind of goes on without anybody... You know, her husband takes her back, and the people in the town say, I'm going all at the war, and we lost all these people because of you. And she says, oh.
It's awesome.
The original bimbo.
Yeah, in some ways, yes. Yeah. Forgot what I was going to say. I would say when you read a lot of these Greek plays, you get more admiration for humans mm-hmm. because the humans suffer and die in these gods. This is especially true, I think, in the Iliad. The humans suffer and die, and the gods, they come in and they do things, but then they don't have as much stake in the matter. And so the humans have to, as you say, human justice is the big thing. And humans, they come off better than the gods.
We die, they don't.
They don't, yeah. Yeah.
And do you think that what the essence of the human nature of theater mm-hmm. that derives from Greek tragedy is ritualistic?
Mm-hmm.
The ritual.
Yeah.
And that what we're missing, as you keep mentioning, mm-hmm. post-traumatic stress yeah. disorder and veterans, like we're a nation and a culture that doesn't say, well, let's do a spiritual ritual with you where you go on your ground for 3 days.
Let's give them medication.
Let's pay attention to your dreams. No. We've lost all sense of ritual, theatrical, like the meaning that is not just symbolic and distant, but through the praxis of theatrical enactment, mm-hmm. that people can really be healed.
Mm-hmm. And use the veterans to heal each other.
Yeah.
But there are 22 suicides a day, the national statistics
yeah.
of Iraqi and Afghani veterans. 22 a day.
Five Vietnam veterans.
Well, there's another aspect of that Greek theater, and I think it's true of contemporary theater. When you go to the theater, you're in a public place. You're with other
yeah.
people, and here are these characters talking about really awful things, like wanting to kill your mother, and things that maybe you thought, oh, nobody'd ever. That's a private, awful thing that I've thought of. But then you, I think that was
it's public.
Yeah, it's public, and I think that was what struck Aristotle too when he talked about catharsis. You see other people thinking this, and you see this in a public place, and so it has a feeling on, and I'm sure it had a healing feeling.
Mm-hmm. It kind of ties the individual to the community mm-hmm. in that moment as an mm-hmm. access, because the community in participating in the drama, the collective is unified with the individual. Mm-hmm. So as we contemplate the individual experience that we're seeing and we're re-experiencing, we're doing it together.
Mm-hmm.
And we're having a collective experience, so it's that dynamic of the individual to the collective.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, there's somebody in the back. Yep.
Last week, a colleague of mine was explaining that
he was being rejected for medical benefits from the VA, and he said there was a classification called Jew Engage in a Theater of Conflict.
Mm-hmm.
And I got really upset. I never had heard that term before, and he said, no, no, that's what's referred to as military.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, did you go to war, were you in battle, did you engage in a theater
of conflict? Yeah.
And I got really upset because they're saying it wasn't real, the battle wasn't real.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. No, it means a place of action,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
Theater in that sense, yeah. Yeah, it in a way it's kind of a euphemism, but there is something theatrical about battles too. And,
doesn't the term theater translate the place of scene? Am I right about that? Does anyone know the Greek meaning?
I don't know
the word theater. I believe it's the place of scene.
Place of scene. Yeah, the place where things would be revealed. Yeah. Like a testing place, too, it could be. Yeah, I think we're finished. Okay. Well, thank you all for coming, and I hope you will all go to see plays.